Good morning. Welcome to Focus 580. This is our telephone talk program. My name is David Inge. Glad to have you with us this morning. We're also pleased to welcome back to the show David Desser. He's professor of cinema studies at the University of Illinois. And every once in a while, he's here and we talk about movies and generally have a good time when he is on the show. If you would like to call in and tell us about something that you have seen recently, that's certainly great. One part of the function of the show should be to give you the opportunity to do some reviews. The summer movie season is now officially over, so if you would like to call in and tell us, for example, what you thought was the best movie that you saw this summer, you could do that. You are curious about what Dave thought about some of the movies that he's seen, you could do that. You have other kinds of questions and comments about movies, you could do that. Whatever's on your mind, as long as it has to do with films, you can call. The number here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. Also, we have a toll-free line, good anywhere that you can hear us, and that is 800-222-9455. So if it would be a long-distance call, you can use that number, and we'll pay for the call. 333-WILL, toll-free, 800-222-WILL. And our guest is, I don't know if I mentioned, David Desser, professor of cinema studies at University of Illinois. Well, thanks for being here once again.
My pleasure.
As I mentioned, the Labor Day, I think, marks the official end of the summer movie season. And as they do in Hollywood, I guess the only way they can decide if things were any good or not was based on how much money they made. So they're looking at box office. And now summer had its usual complement of big budget special effects action movies. However, apparently, the top two grossing films of the summer were Shrek, an animated movie, and Rush Hour 2. With Jackie
also
Chan.
Also an animated movie. Very animated.
And they did better than Pearl Harbor, Planet of the Apes, Tomb Raider. I don't know what are the other big movies that were maybe people thought might do really big business.
Yes, probably the biggest disappointment might have been Spielberg's AI, artificial intelligence. You know, from Spielberg, you expect a lot. From the combination Spielberg and Kubrick, you might expect a lot. So that was probably the biggest disappointment. But I'm sure they also thought that Pearl Harbor would do a lot better since they spent an awful lot of money on that. And Tomb Raider, which did really well for a couple of weeks, they're probably pleased but maybe disappointed considering how it started. And again, Planet of the Apes was a bit of a bomb. But a lot of the movies did a lot worse than expected. I'm not really surprised, but when you look at it, Jurassic Park 3 and Dr. Dolittle 2, considering how well the previous ones did, also have to be reckoned at least disappointments, if not flops, which I would say Dr. Dolittle 2 is something of a flop. But there were other big surprises, too, such as The Princess Diaries. Disney's live-action movie did really, really well. So overall box office was very strong, though admissions were down slightly from previous summer. Box office dollars were up because the price of admission is up. Mm-hmm. But overall admissions were down just a percent or two, so Hollywood had a decent enough summer. But I'm sure no one would have predicted the success of Shrek, and Rush Hour 2 happened to be a big hit, but I think everyone predicted that.
Yeah. Well, I guess it just shows to go you that movies are sort of a mystery, and nobody, if somebody really knew what the way to make a movie that was guaranteed to make money was, they would do that, and then that person would be the king of Hollywood. But apparently there is no such thing.
Well, as I've said many times, no one sets out to make a bad movie. Or if they do set out to make a bad movie, they don't set out to make a movie that doesn't make any money. but you know, sometimes it's easy to say why movies didn't make as much money as they thought, and that is the movie isn't very good. I mean, there's no way you could go to the mat and say, well, you know, Planet of the Apes sure should have done better, or Tomb Raider sure should have done better. In fact, they did much better than they deserve, from my perspective. So in that respect, you know, the movies aren't that good. On the other hand, movies that are good don't always make as much money as they should. So it's not just a matter of what makes money and what doesn't. But, you know, the biggest box office disappointment was the latest Julia Roberts American whatever that was called.
American Beauty.
Sweethearts.
Yes, yes.
And there
American
was
Beauty, that was a yeah, different movie.
That was which made a lot more money than people. But America's Sweethearts was the surefire success that had to be. You know, super hot Julia Roberts, Catherine Zeta-Jones, John Cusack, Billy Crystal, light romantic comedy. It had all the elements going in, and although it did respectable business, it didn't really do that much. And that's the kind of thing where you just have to throw up your hands and say, look, the movie wasn't bad. The actors are great. Everyone loves everything about it, but it just didn't make that much money. Hmm. And, you know, again, if that movie's not going to do that well and it turns out a good movie, you're really in trouble. No one knows.
We have a caller here on a car phone. Why don't we get to them right here, line number one. Hello.
Hi. I wanted to ask David to make a statement, but first let me just say that AI was an absolutely horrible movie, very typical of Kubrick's movies, as a matter of fact, who I consider the most overrated director of our time. It was probably worse than 2001, and that, in my view, would be hard to make a worse movie than that. And the big movie that appeared locally in the best this summer, I would have called The Anniversary Party. But rather than going into that, I'd like David to possibly address, this is an appropriate date for this, the role of Pauline Kael in film criticism and whether and how she might have brought film criticism from an academic discipline to the masses and how her followers... all the critics who followed her have taken her lead or not taken her lead. I mean, we're talking about the most influential film critic of, I suppose, the last half of the century. So I'd like to hear his comments on her.
Well, excellent thought. She just passed away
yesterday. She passed away yesterday. No, I'm glad that was brought up. But I do want to say a couple things quickly. A, I agree with you about Kubrick. though not about 2001, but I do think Kubrick is by far the most overrated director of all time, not just our time. And The Anniversary Party was a very nice film, but that's not the kind of film that people are going to see in big numbers. But it is a very successful film, and I do recommend people who didn't see The Anniversary Party, that's a perfectly good film to see on video. So that's my video pick for about 4 or 5 months from now when it comes out. As for Pauline Kael, I was thinking about that. Her influence on film criticism is, of course, absolutely enormous. And she functioned in a very interesting way. She comes out before sort of the institutionalization of film studies. So she's not an academic critic, but she certainly has lots and lots of academic respect. But she's also far more than, you know, the daily kind of reviewer in the newspapers. She wrote for The New Yorker, a very influential magazine. New York as the kind of cultural capital of America, she had a lot more influence and power than the readership of the magazine itself. And she's kind of what I think of as a sort of public intellectual. And that is, she has a much bigger readership than most academics. But she has a kind of thoughtful discourse in the public realm, in the public sphere. So she writes thoughtful, lengthy, intelligent reviews. And in a certain way, she, in a way, helps bring about film studies because she brings a great deal of respectability to film. Mostly because she was a terrific writer, and she took film very seriously. Now, I actually don't have that much, I don't share much of her tastes. If she didn't like a film, that didn't mean I wasn't going to go see it. But there was no question that she was insightful. There was no question that she could really, really write. And there's no question that she, along with another film critic who is quite older now, and that's Andrew Saras, they together helped to bring about film studies. And so, you know, it's an incalculable influence. But as I say, this public intellectual idea is that she was a kind of spokesman for a mass audience compared to what academics get. And she demonstrated that you can write seriously about film, think seriously about film. On the other hand, she wasn't particularly pretentious. When film studies began and so-called film theory began, she was not that much in favor of it, and so she provided a kind of healthy corrective to some of the understandable excesses of where academic film criticism was going. So, you know, I look at her as a kind of James Agee type, someone whose intelligence and ability to write well, in a way, helped elevate the medium that they took seriously.
Hmm. Are there collections of her reviews available if people wanted to go back and read some stuff?
Yes, she probably was the first working film critic to have her columns collected. Because her essays were fairly lengthy, you could actually, you know, read them with some, you know, with some seriousness and some depth. And there's probably four or five bound volumes. One of her collections I always thought was a great 1001 Nights at the Cinema or Going to the Movies. There's at least four or five that can easily be had. And reading film criticism, especially of hers, is a lot of fun because it also tells you, not only reminds you of those films, but reminds you of what was going on sort of in the world. She was really a lot of power and a lot of respect. Now, apparently, personally, she was very hard to get along with, but I never met her, and so I didn't have to worry about that. I could just read her, which I did. And, you know, it was important that the New Yorker kind of, you know, you had your theater critic, of, you know, like Ring Lardner Jr., and so it was a very important time for film studies to be helped by her writing.
We're talking this morning with Dave Desser. He's professor of cinema studies at University of Illinois. And every once in a while he's here, and we talk about movies. We're going to pause for just a second to do this, and then we'll continue. This is a test of the emergency alert system. And this is Focus 580, our telephone talk program. My name is David Inge, and our guest this morning, David Desser, and we're talking about movies. So any sorts of comments, questions that you have, particularly if you're just interested in talking about something that you've seen this summer, maybe a film that you thought was particularly good or something that you thought was particularly bad, or other film-related questions are certainly welcome. 333-WILL, toll-free. 800-222-WILL. There's been, I think, reviewers and reviewing lately have gotten a fair amount of bad press. Of course, there was the famous story of the reviewer that didn't exist.
Oh, yes.
And there are criticisms of reviewers taking freebies and whatever they can get, basically exchanging good reviews for perks. And one wonders, does anybody take, the vast majority of reviewers, does anybody take them seriously? Does anybody even pay attention to the blurbs, all those things that said, this was the greatest movie I've ever seen in my life, that, you know, that appear in the ads? Does anybody pay attention to that?
Well, I don't know how that can be judged, and I certainly don't know anyone who does, but I might be a special case where I'm going to go see anything that I feel like seeing regardless. But people clearly do take movie reviews seriously. When Roger Ebert and Gene Siskel began their TV reviewing, which is still on the air, you'll remember that not only did they have their show, but there were, in fact, at one time, two others. And so there's certainly a lot of interest. Reviewing also, because it's a kind of public forum, makes people feel like they can participate. And there's such a difference between, you know, what academics do and what film reviewers do. And sometimes I feel bad that academic so-called scholarship or criticism isn't read much more widely. Because, it really does not, therefore, engage most of the people who go to movies. So I think reviewing is a kind of not only a consumer guide that many people probably do rely on. People who need to choose, you know, can go to the movies only once or twice a month or even less. You know, what is the best way for them to choose? And I suspect many of the more thoughtful people do look at over, you know, the review in the New York Times, the review in Newsweek or Time Magazine. The local reviews here, I think people pay attention to. I know a lot of people do. So I think there is a lot. But those blurbs, of course, are silly. And if you ever look at some really bad movies and then you see who's giving a blurb, besides the fact that sometimes it's made up, it's just people in newspapers you never heard of who may very well be right. And, of course, some critics, you know, very, very likely want to have their you know, one of the year's 10 best, a laugh riot, you know. So you get to be your name, you write for whatever newspaper syndicate that exists or doesn't, and there you are in there. But the danger, I think, is that the so-called press junket, which America's Sweethearts is actually about. Interestingly enough, we talked about that film before. And right. So it's very difficult, you know, the closer you get to the business, the more difficult it is to be objective. And in fact, there was a quote-unquote scandal, or at least a lot of troubles, in the Hollywood world, where the Hollywood Reporter and Variety have both been in some trouble. A Variety critic working for the studios. You know, that's really a kind of incestuous relationship. And so the closer a film reviewer gets to the people who make movies, the more difficult it is for them to give bad reviews. Mm-hmm. So it's a danger, you know, but I think it's fun. As I say, for me, the reviewing provides a kind of place for people to argue. And with the Internet, the number of sort of movie review sites on the Internet is literally uncountable. And everybody can have an opinion, and I think that's good.
Okay. Everybody can have an opinion here, too, by
that's
the way.
Right.
If you'd like to call in, 333-9455 and toll-free 800-222-9455. Here's someone to talk with in Champaign. This is line number one. Hello.
Yeah, good morning. I'm sorry, but I've got to rise to the defense of Stanley Kubrick. while maybe he is overrated, it's hard not to be considering the, you know, accolades he's gotten. He's also one of the... during his career, one of the most criticized. But at the same time, I have to say that Dr. Strangelove, for my money, is one of the best movies that America has yet to produce. And I've seen it maybe a dozen times and always get something new out of it. And I certainly liked early film Paths of Glory, and I continue to think that his film Barry Lyndon is very much underappreciated.
Well, I, you know, it would be silly for me to argue too much against Kubrick, but I mean, overrated really is what I literally mean. The previous caller about Kubrick, I think, was way too hard on 2001, which I don't think is by any means a terrible film. In fact, it's in many ways a splendid film. But overrated means that Kubrick gets a lot more credit than in fact he deserves, and I'll go on record as saying, I mean, I disagree with you about Barry Lyndon, though. If you do see it, you have to see it in a theater. I mean, it's certainly visually splendid, but I actually think it's in every way a failure except visually. But Paths of Glory, The Killing, Dr. Strangelove, 2001, and Clockwork Orange are all really superior films. But I do think that following that, there's very little to offer, even though on behalf of Full Metal Jacket, say. But I thought Eyes Wide Shut was just one of the worst films I've ever seen, and I can't imagine what everyone was thinking unless Kubrick simply didn't finish it. But I just think overrated is the word. That doesn't mean he's a terrible filmmaker, and it doesn't mean that Dr. Strangelove, for instance, isn't a great film, which it is. And so is Clockwork Orange in its unpleasant but powerful way. So I just have to say I think he's overrated. But then I'll say that Hitchcock is overrated. Doesn't mean I'm thinking Hitchcock is a bad filmmaker by any means. It just means that people talk way more about Hitchcock and Kubrick than perhaps they deserve, or that we've heard what there is to say and let's move on to other filmmakers. So that's all. I mean, I certainly support your defense of Kubrick, don't get me wrong. But that's
all right,
my feeling
thank
you. About overrated. That's all.
Thanks.
Okay, let's go to Mansfield here, line number two. Hello.
Hi. Mm-hmm. First of all, I enjoy your show very much. And then second of all, I wanted to ask, I want to support children's films, really well-made children's films. So we went to see Spy Kids, and gosh, I thought it was really dreadful.
Well, good. Then you'll be online when Spy Kids 2 comes out next summer.
That's not a very quick turnaround for Spy Kids 2. Was I completely wrong here, or to find it really silly, or maybe I went into it with too much of an adult sensibility?
Spy Kids?
Mm-hmm.
Actually, I didn't see it.
Oh.
So I can't, I don't have a youngster anymore.
I don't either, but I wanted to go. Oh. I thought it was supposed to be really, you know, entertaining and good, and, you know.
Oh.
And I read more than just the blurbs, too.
Yes, no, well, as I say, I hadn't seen it, but obviously it made a lot of money, and there is a Spy Kids, too, but I, you know, it's hard to comment on a... I'm not driven that much to see films that I think are mostly for kids. The one film that I will see that's mostly for kids is the upcoming film about the young wizard school.
Harry Potter.
Harry
yes,
Potter.
Indeed.
The previews look wonderful.
The previews do look wonderful. So I'll actually go see Harry Potter, whether my aging daughter in her mid-teens will see it or not.
What about the current film at the Art? Any information on Maid? Because we're just going to see it tonight.
Well, the reviews have been negative, and all I have seen was the preview.
Mm-hmm.
And you shouldn't judge a film by its preview, because previews take the best of a film. But when I saw the preview, I said, there's no way I want to see this film. And if that's the best of the film, I'm going to pass. Now, I like the two guys, Jon Favreau and Vince Vaughn, and I like the actress Famke Janssen. But everything about it seems universally to be the case that this is a film about an unpleasant character. And, you know, there's something, can you watch a film about a bad guy or someone you don't like?
That's true.
And that's, so again, haven't seen Made, but it's something that I'll probably see on video because I like the people involved. But and I don't want to discourage people ever from going to the art, which tends to show good films. But this one, I just have to say that I was turned off by the trailer, and reviews have been fairly uniformly negative.
Okay, and then my last question is, do you have any comments on O, the movie?
My comment is that I haven't seen it because it just opened last week. But I also think that it's really unfair for the film to get a kind of that films often get publicity not for what they are, but for what happened to them or for what they may or may not be about. And, of course, O was made by Miramax, which decided that given its kind of high school setting and its violent climax, it occurred right around the time of Columbine. And so Miramax first held it for release and then 18 months later sold it to a smaller company, which now put it out. So the film is actually 18 months finished and, you know, 28 months or so or 24 months since it was made. So it's really unfair to think about this film in any way as participating in a kind of Columbine, you know, exploitation.
Before Columbine,
They started making it well before Columbine. You know, it's an interesting idea. There's so many adaptations lately of Shakespeare.
Shakespeare, yeah.
And what's secondly interesting is so many adaptations of Shakespeare for sort of teenagers and youngsters.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what's really interesting, since Shakespeare is, you know, this kind of high culture, grown-up sort of stuff, and yet all the Shakespeare things are out. And there's another version of Hamlet they keep making that no one has yet seen.
Could be a subversive plot by English teachers who want to have something to show in class, perhaps.
Well, I don't know if O is going to be one of them, however.
Okay, well, so. Thank you so much.
Okay, thanks. So it's Othello.
It's Othello?
It's basically.
It's Othello on the basketball court. So, you know, it's tough to find the kind of equivalence. But, of course, it's not Othello. It's the plot of Othello. There's no Shakespeare dialogue of any kind. It's in certain ways the basic plot of Othello. Three very fine actors, I'll have to say that. In that respect, there can be something to say. Again, haven't seen it. Have seen some things, but so far nothing that anyone's mentioned.
Well, the thing, just real quick, a comment about Spy Kids, I guess. It strikes me that this is the kind of movie that may only appeal to viewers that are the age of the principal actors. I'm thinking that this is a movie that pretty much was made for 10-year-old kids, and I'm not sure if it's possible it seems to me that it's a difficult thing to make a film. It's not impossible because it's been done, but it's a difficult thing to make a film that's really going to appeal to children and their parents both.
Well, generally when people say fun for the whole family, what they really mean is that kids will probably like it and the grown-ups won't be particularly offended unless it's bad. But that's often the case. So, yeah, I agree. I mean, I think people have really lost the ability. Today's studios, I think, have lost the ability, with one or two exceptions, to make films about truly mature people, and have lost the ability to make films for everybody. That kids' films are much too juvenile and may appeal to juveniles, literally, or pre-adolescents, don't know how to make films for and about grown-ups in particular. They become too juvenile.
But already at our midpoint here in this part of Focus, Dave Desser is with us. He's a professor of cinema studies at University of Illinois. And every once in a while, he's here. We talk about films. You can tell us about what you've been seeing or ask other questions. 333-9455, toll free, 800-222-9455. We'll go to Taylorville here next, line number 4. Hello?
Yeah, well, I'm very much more into films made for grown-ups. I frankly resent the Disneyfication of the universe, which seems to be going on at a certain hilarious pace. I was just recalling when someone asked Mr. Orson Welles what his influences were. He said, John Ford, John Ford, John Ford. And I was remembering Stagecoach, which beautiful movie. There's hardly a minute that's negligible. For example, that business where The Ringo Kid character, John Wayne, looks up at Claire Trevor and makes up his mind. There's nothing said. It's a beautiful business, worthy of a silent film, from which I suspect that was inspired. That slow smile that comes across his face. There are just so many. Minute for minute, I think that's the best Western ever made. Although I might quibble with myself about flicks like The Wild Bunch and certain others. Ride the High Country, for example. Getting even deeper in the film, I would like to point out that there's a great foreign flick coming on TCM this Saturday morning at 1 called Andrei Rublev, which is just dazzling. I see a certain thing, just as in our politics, going on, namely entropy. I see a certain thing in American cinema. I'd call it imbecilification, this business about appealing to children. Surely there are lots of them, but children by and large, I hate to sound like somebody who hates children. I don't. I think they're cute. Yeah, just like their movies. I think there's too much of that going on in this bitch of a civilization.
Well, Dave, comments?
Yeah, about a million, but first I support you with Stagecoach, though it is kind of fun to say what's the best Western and all that. But it's also funny you mentioned that John Ford, of course, got his start in silent cinema, and one of the reasons why he's such a great director is that he didn't feel compelled to have everybody talk all the time. So Stagecoach is a wonderful film. Second of all, there's no question that far too many films are made for what Hollywood thinks is the so-called youth audience. The fact of the matter is that Hollywood knows that young people go to the movies with more regularity than anybody else. High school students, in particular, go to the movies more often than anybody. So while every so-called teen comedy doesn't make money, enough do, and they're also relatively inexpensive to make. They don't have to pay teen stars $20 million a picture. So they're actually, the profit margins are okay. So, you know, Hollywood has found its audience and only occasionally makes other films. The other thing is Hollywood makes a lot of films with an eye toward the international market, which means, in a certain way, it means they're actually less interesting than they used to be because they want to have less content than they ever did because people will see the films dubbed with subtitles and, you know, it's just, you know, the more action, the better, and the less content, the better. The less specificity, the better, except that, you know, they're all Hollywood stars. Although not all Hollywood stars, they're also Asian stars and Australian stars and British stars. So Hollywood is international, partly to appeal to an international audience. But I also think that entropy is a very good word, because for years and years, Hollywood has kind of been spinning its wheels. And that's why also... they're importing talent with greater always have imported talent with great regularity, and they continue to import talent with great regularity. But that's also why Hollywood has proven so open to influences. David and I talk every time I'm here about Hong Kong cinema, and yet the Hong Kong influence is more apparent than ever. And I'll just point out, coming out Friday is The Musketeer. And everything I've seen in the previews for The Musketeer, it looks like a Hong Kong movie set in medieval France. And so that's some of my responses to that. But it is the case that the youth, so-called youth audience, and these gross-out comedies such as the tremendously successful American Pie 2, as long as those movies make money or enough money, Hollywood will keep churning them out. But people over a certain age it's easily understandable for me that they don't want to go to the movies that often. Right. And I go only about half as much as I used to.
I appreciate the comments of the car. We got somebody here on a cell phone. I want to get to them next. Line 3. Hello?
Yeah, caller. I was just calling to sort of take issue with statements that were made earlier regarding maybe the overrating of directors. And I would agree that certainly some directors, I would agree that probably Kubrick is overrated, though, as the panelist did say, he has some excellent films. And I would certainly agree that Steven Spielberg is overrated. However, when someone says that Alfred Hitchcock is overrated, I have to take issue with that because the highest rating that one could possibly give a director such as Hitchcock or John Ford or Orson Welles, as someone also said, would be the best director ever, and I would certainly agree that all three of those are up in that category. Perhaps they're over-talked and their films have been overplayed and run into the ground as sort of the canon of classic cinema. However, I can't really agree with someone who would say that Alfred Hitchcock could be overrated, seeing as how he is arguably one of the greatest directors of all time.
Well, I appreciate your point, and I'll stand by my comment, but I will say that part of the reason that I say overrated is over-talked about and overplayed. And so in that respect, as if there was no one, I mean, in a way, we have established Hitchcock's greatness. Do we need to keep reasserting that? And I'll also say, if you put the 10 best movies of all time, would you put a Hitchcock movie in there? It's not that I think Hitchcock has made, you know, is anyone really going to go for Psycho? It's a great film, but are you prepared to say, so, I mean, if you do it in that respect, yes, Hitchcock's made, you know, a good solid dozen films that are really, really good. But do any of them really qualify as transcendently great, or is there just a consistency across his films? People like North by Northwest, but are you prepared to say that's one of the greatest films? That's partly what I mean, but mainly I do mean overplayed and over-talked about, and thus overrated to in comparison to the fact that people don't talk very much about Orson Welles anymore, and even John Ford, though all filmmakers pay tribute. I'll put it another way. What Hitchcock, I mean, except for the horror film and Psycho, Hitchcock goes in cycles, and he's certainly been very influential. But how many filmmakers, you know, really rework Hitchcock as often as they rework, say, Citizen Kane or The Searchers or Kurosawa's films? But anyway, you know, I can't, you know, I'm not going to say Hitchcock isn't a great director. That's silly. But just to be polemical, because I'm sure Kubrick has as many fans as he has, but as I say, to me, overrated really, in a way, does mean overplayed and over-talked about.
All right, then. Let me ask you this. Supposing on your top 10 list of greatest directors of all time, who, just mention a few people that you would say maybe were, or it doesn't necessarily need to be 10, I mean, among the best film directors.
Well, I would have to say Ford. I would have to say Kurosawa. I would have to say Buster Keaton. And I don't want to get too obscure, but I would if I had a top 10, I'd find Hitchcock around 9 or 10.
Well, he probably would be on,
yeah,
on the list.
On top 10 directors, yeah. Directors. So, and he would be on my top 10, but he'd be at the bottom of the top 10. But I would have to say, for me, it's John Ford and Akira Kurosawa. Other directors, you know, might be a little obscure, and I don't want to sound too weird. And also, you get into the question of who's a great director and who's a favorite director. I don't know about all time, but a great director working today is Martin Scorsese. But except for one or two of his films, I don't think anybody would really go to the mat for the greatness of his films. But you could not deny the superior confidence of his filmmaking. Though I do think Gangs of America, is that his upcoming film? Gangs of New York?
I think something like that.
I think whatever his new film
Gangs
is.
Gangs somewhere.
Gangs of New York, maybe. I think that film is very interestingly in danger of being a big flop. So we shall see. And for all those who've been waiting for Leonardo DiCaprio with bated breath, that's what he's been doing. But, you know, I have favorite directors as well, but for me, I think I'd have to put Buster Keaton perhaps up there as someone who is underrated, even though he's highly rated. People don't, I think, appreciate the genius of Buster Keaton as a film director, whereas people do appreciate the genius of Alfred Hitchcock as a film director. So I'll put Keaton in my top category.
Well, that's another one of those things I think that's sort of sad, that people don't have the chance to see silent film. So how many people have seen much Buster Keaton?
Well, not only to see silent films, though they were all released on the DVD and Laserdisc, but it's not just silent films, it's also silent films in theaters. And that's really the difference. Silent films are very hard to watch on TV because TV is really an audio medium. The screen is small, no one really wants to sit and you know, watch. so silent, and I had a chance to see Buster Keaton's films projected at a decent theater. in New York City when I was in college some years ago. And that's when I realized, I mean, I'd only vaguely heard of Buster Keaton, but when I saw Buster Keaton's films, and when I saw most of his films sort of in a row, that's when I said, this is an incredible filmmaker. And that's the difference. You can appreciate him, but you've got to see him the way they were, partly the way they were meant to be seen, because you'll never actually see him the way they were meant to be seen. When we don't have to get into the difference between black and white film now and black and white film in the old days.
All right. Well, again, I appreciate the comments of the call. We've got some other folks, and let's go to Marshall. So this will be line number one. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
I just wanted to make a comment about two films that we've enjoyed through the years. One is Those Magnificent Men and Their Flying Machines, and it's A Mad, 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 Mad World. Our family's got a lot of fun out of those, too.
Yeah, that was Mad, 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 was just on TV, though it doesn't play that well on TV. And interestingly enough, people do remember those films because they've inspired the very new film that's currently playing called Rat Race. But see, what Rat Race did was, you know, that's instructive from the previous caller talked about kind of making movies imbecilic. Well, Rat Race is a kind of pleasant comedy, but they throw in things that Mad, Mad, Mad World or Magnificent Men never would. And so they're not as fun as they might be, because they feel the need every so often to throw in, you know, everything. People don't realize, but now the rating that is most desired is the PG-13 that presses the envelope for an R. And so movies that really would play best and most pleasantly if they were PG really need to get to PG-13. On the other hand, movies that really might deserve an R to really communicate what they want are being scaled back to get to PG-13. So in that respect, PG-13, though it was an important rating, is actually having some interesting effects.
I just was thinking how much fun those actors and actresses had to have putting that together.
Well, also for Mad, Mad, Mad World, yeah. I actually remember seeing it when it first came out, and I was young. And it came out in the super wide screen, 70 millimeter, and so it was a huge thing. But also, for those of us of a certain age, that movie is so much fun because you could not get a cast like that together. Again, I mean, you know, even if you didn't like the movie, you have to like it. It's just everybody who's funny is in it. And the star, you know, who's not even funny is Spencer Tracy. So everybody who's funny and Spencer Tracy, who actually could be a great comic actor. But it's just one of those things that you couldn't really do again. Or Hollywood doesn't know how.
All right. Well, thank you. Let's go on to, Naperville, line number two. Hello.
Yeah, hi.
Mm-hmm.
Professor, I graduated from Lewis University in 79, and I've taken some film courses, and they were telling us how films influence us. And you know what? They do. They're like how The West Was Won, our school made us go there when I was in grade school. But what we used to laugh about, and I'm a former right-wing extremist, we used to always say in that Stanley Kubrick film, it was Henry Kissinger.
Before Henry? Yeah, Dr. Strangelove.
Yep.
Yeah.
Exactly. And, I mean, we used to laugh about that. Even I was a right-wing extremist back then, and we used to laugh about that. So, so you know... That's life, right?
Right.
Hey, look, have a good one.
Okay, thanks for the call. It is a great movie.
Dr. Strangelove,
I think this is a great movie.
It is a great movie. And the funniest thing about Dr. Strangelove is it comes out the same time as Failsafe. So you've got this one heavy movie, Sidney Lumet, you know, very fine director, mm-hmm. Henry Fonda, who, and then you have Dr. Strangelove. And I think, unfortunately for Failsafe, Dr. Strangelove is much more perceptive film.
Yeah. That's, you know, a couple of times I've talked with Nell Minow, who is daughter of
Newt
Minow, who has an online film reviewing site, and she's also got a book out and she writes columns. And her sort of thing is movies for families. But what's sort of fun in a book that she wrote is she suggests unusual combinations of movies for film, like home film festivals. And I think that's one of the ones she says, wouldn't that be interesting to watch those two movies back to back? Or she would say, you know, watch Son of Frankenstein and then watch Young Frankenstein. And if you do that, you could see Mel stole everything.
Well, not only did he steal everything, literally stole everything because he used the sets. He used the actual sets.
Really? Yeah,
so he knew he was stealing everything. Really? He's not trying to hide anything.
Well, I love that movie. That's my favorite Mel Brooks movie, Young Frankenstein.
Well, Young Frankenstein's in my top three of Mel's.
All right. Well, let's go on here. We'll go to Champagne right here, line three.
Hello, Professor. I read the Tribune, Chicago Tribune, and New York Times daily, and there's a movie they list as perhaps one of the better movies of the year, The Deep End. Has that movie come to Champaign? I've been waiting for it to come to Champaign, and I haven't seen it. Are you familiar with that movie?
I'm getting bad on tiles. Do you remember anything about it?
No, all I know, it's I can't remember any of the synopsis of it, other than the people to say it's one of the best movies of the year, The Deep End.
It vaguely rings a bell, and I'm going to say that, although I can't remember quite what it is, it probably hasn't come to Champaign yet. Now, I was away all summer. I don't know what the art had, but if it's playing only in places like New York and Chicago, then it probably hasn't come here.
Okay.
Again, it's getting harder for me. I try and keep up with all the films that, such as Weekly Variety reviews films that, you know, you'll never see in a million years. And
all
I get, and I get, you know, at the Karlovy Vary Film Festival and things like that. So I just wish I could remember The Deep
All
End.
Right. I'm sorry then. Thank you very much.
Okay. We have, let's see, another call here. We'll go to Aurora, line four. Hello.
Yeah, thank you for that statement you made about there not being films. How can I quote you? Thanks for your statement about the average film isn't...
it's not for grown-ups?
Not for grown-ups. I mean, I see them and I think, is it me or is it them? And I'm so glad you made the statement and said it straight. I really thank you for that. What is a good adult movie that's out right now that you could recommend?
Well, I wish I could recommend right now anything. Of course, you know, the summertime is not the time serious films.
Yes, I've been hearing people say that.
So, you know, it's very true. And so hopefully there'll be some films in November and December that will be for grown-ups.
I'm sorry.
No, go right ahead.
I went on vacation with a granddaughter that I wanted to please.
Mm-hmm.
So I got the list from Mel Minow of children's movies that were good. And I got The Iron Giant.
Uh-huh.
That is a wonderful, wonderful movie. All the adults and one child sat there mesmerized by this wonderful film for a child.
No, that's right. That is a fine film. But, you know, one of the problems is grown-ups won't often go see animated films. And so...
Oh, is that...
Yeah, no, they won't. Especially, what's happened.
The animation in that, I don't know how those artists did that. Oh, I just don't know how they did some of those things. It was just... It was a wonderful film. I would recommend it for adults.
Well, good.
Thank you so much.
All right, thanks. Just Craig Cohen was good enough to come in, and he looked up a little information on The Deep End.
Good.
This is it was directed by Scott McGee, David Siegel III. I'm afraid those are directors not known to me. The plot line, a woman spirals out of control while trying to keep her son from being found culpable in a murder investigation. And I think that this is, Tilda Swinton is in this movie. And it was just reviewed, I think, or I know just recently I read an article about her, and I want to say maybe it was in the New York Times. I'm not sure. But in any case, I don't think this movie has come to Champaign-Urbana yet. That's my thought.
Well, that's either a British film, which it might be since Tilda Swinton is British, or it's an American independent film.
Now, I think that it's American independent.
Yeah, American. Of course, one of the sad things is that as the Hollywood studios have produced films with ever bigger budgets, it's paradoxically more difficult to see American independent and foreign films than it ever has been, because most of these Hollywood films open on more than one screen. So over the summer, you'll see a 20-plex will have maybe only 13 or 14 films. When Jay and Silent Bob Strike Back opens on two screens, either someone doesn't quite know what they're talking about, although the film did respectable business, or you can see that even mid-range Hollywood films are pushing out films like The Deep End. But on the other hand, the good news is The Deep End is definitely the kind of film that will show up on video. But I was just looking over my Christmas time releases, and I can point out that films that I—and it is called Gangs of New York, the Scorsese film— but two films in particular that I want to have great hope for being grown-up films. One is The Shipping News, based on the Ann Prule novel.
Mm-hmm. Very good book.
With Kevin Spacey, Julianne Moore, Judi Dench, and Cate Blanchett.
Pretty good cast.
Nice cast.
I know what they're doing.
Directed by Lassie Hallström, whose latest film, Chocolat, was a film for grown-ups. And a film directed by Ron Howard, who used to be a juvenile star, but who's become a decent director. And Ron Howard has a film called A Beautiful Mind with Russell Crowe and Ed Harris. And so these kinds of films, of course, the typical Christmas releases, hopeful Oscar for Best Picture or Best Actor. So films like A Beautiful Mind or The Shipping News will hold out some hope for grown-ups. The other thing I wanted to say about Christmas is it's a funny world where you have not one but two big-budget fantasy films coming out almost at the same time, because for many of us who grew up on Tolkien's The Lord of the Rings and remember, unhappily, the Ralph Bakshi film of some two decades ago, mm-hmm. You've got Harry Potter in November and Lord of the Rings in December, and it would be interesting to see that if they're both good films, and I'm hopeful they both are, can they both do a lot of business? And if so, will we see a resurgence of the very unsuccessful genre of the fantasy film, which almost never produces good films, by the way?
Hmm. We're almost at the point where we have to finish. One of the things I try to ask when you're on the program is, okay, so you're not happy with what's in the theaters now. You're going to go down to the video place and rent your tape or your DVD. Is there anything that perhaps has come out in, recently that you would know that would be there that you would think you people might want to take a look at?
Yes, two films. The underrated, Oh Brother, Where Art Thou? I think that film is way better than everyone has given it credit for, and that's on video, and I recommend Oh Brother, Where Art Thou? And also, a British-American small film that people who can tolerate the odd and the offbeat, Blow Dry. Alan Rickman as a hairdresser caught up in the British hairdressing competition of that year. But Blow Dry is a really, really nice little film, and Oh Brother, Where Art Thou is a much better, bigger film than people get. And George Clooney is great.
Really? You know, that's something you don't hear nowadays. Yeah,
well,
that often. George Clooney is great.
And for people around here, especially Alison Krauss and Union Station's music.
The music from that movie has been a big hit,
yes,
and has gotten people interested in bluegrass music
that
weren't before.
And the movie is... The Coen Brothers, I think it's their best film in many years. I think it's better than Fargo.
Really?
So,
well, all right.
There you have it.
There you go. And also, I'd just like to mention for people who are in the viewing area for WILL-TV that you might check out our program Critics' Choice. This Thursday night, it's going to be on at 7:30, and a couple of the movies that we have talked about will be reviewed by the critics. O will be one of them, along with Jeepers Creepers, Rat Race, and Summer Catch. So if you're interested in getting some reviews there, you can check it out. It's Critics' Choice on WILL-TV Thursday night at 7:30. And thanks very much for
being
here. We appreciate it. David Desser, Professor of Cinema Studies at the University of Illinois. Programming here on AM 580 made possible in part by a grant from the Thrifty Nickel, distributed each Thursday over 100 towns in East Central Illinois, on the web at www.thriftynickel.com. The Thrifty Nickel, it's a good little paper. In the next part of Focus 580, we'll be talking with Dr. Michelle Borba, and we'll be talking about her book, Building Moral Intelligence, The Seven Essential Virtues That Teach Kids to Do the Right Thing. That'll be in a little bit. Right now, though, we'll break for an update on the market, so please stay tuned.